space jump, but I'm still troubled. Our pursuers cast a wide net. I would not be quick to dismiss the possibility that this place is a trap. Or our salvation, Garimi suggested.
We'll have to see for ourselves, Teg said.
Working with the bridge controls, he displayed high-resolution images on the wide screens.
Plentiful oxygen and vegetation, especially at the higher latitudes away from the equator. Clear signs of habitation, small villages, mid-sized cities, mostly far to the north. Large-scale meteorological scans show that the climate is in upheaval.
He pointed to storm patterns, swaths of dying forests and plains, large lakes and inland seas shriveling into dust bowls. Very few clouds in the equatorial latitudes. Minimal atmospheric moisture. Stilgar and Liat Kynes, always fascinated with new worlds, joined the group on the high deck. Kynes drew a quick breath.
It's turning into a wasteland down there. An artificial desert.
I've seen this before.
Shiana studied a clear brown band like a knife slash across what had apparently been a lushly forested continent.
It's like Chapter House.
Could this be one of Odraid's seed planets? Stuka asked, from her usual position at Garimi's side. Did they bring sand trout here and disperse them? Will we find our sisters down on that planet?
Untainted sisters, Garimi said with a gleam in her eyes.
Quite possibly, Shiana said.
We'll have to go down there.
This looks like more than a place to replenish our resources.
A new colony.
Stuka's excitement was infectious.
This could be the world we've been looking for. A site to reestablish Chapter House. A new dune.
Duncan nodded. We cannot pass up an opportunity like this. My instincts brought us here for a reason. Are we the last ones left alive? What if the enemy has destroyed the rest of mankind by now, back in the old empire? Back with Myrbella? In that case, it is imperative that we establish as many colonies as possible. Duncan, Idaho. No ship logs. Keeping themselves hidden from the planet's inhabitants, several teams of efficient Bene Gesserits launched a major effort to restock the no-ship with necessary air, water, and chemicals. They sent out mining ships, air scoops, water purification tankers. That was the Ithaca's immediate priority. Stilgar and Liat Kynes insisted on going down to inspect the growing desert band. Seeing the passion on the faces of the two awakened Golas, neither Teg nor Duncan could deny the request. Everyone was guardedly optimistic about finding a welcoming landscape here, and Shiana wondered if this might be a place where she could release her 7 captive sandworms. Although Duncan could not leave the veiling of the no-ship, because then he would be exposed to the enemy searchers, he had no cause to prevent the others from finding a home at last. Perhaps this would be it. Bashar Teg piloted the lighter down to the surface himself, accompanied by Shiana and an eager Stuka, who had long wanted to establish a new Bene Gesserit center, rather than just drift aimlessly in space. Garimi had let her staunch supporter make the first foray while she formulated plans with her ultra-conservative sisters aboard the no-ship. Stilgar and Liat were most eager just to set foot on the desert, a real desert with open skies and endless sands. Teg flew directly toward the ravaged arid zone where an ecological battle was taking place. If this was indeed one of Odraid's seed planets, the Bashar knew how voracious sand trout would seal away a planet's water, drop by drop. Environmental checks and balances would fight back with shifting weather patterns. Animals would migrate to still untouched regions. Stranded plant life would struggle to adapt and mostly fail.
reproducing sand trout could act much faster than a world could adapt. Shiana and Stuka stared through the lighter's plaz viewing windows, seeing the spreading desert as a success, a triumph of Odraid's scattering. To the exquisitely prudent Bene Gesserit, even the ruin of an entire ecosystem was an acceptable casualty if it created a new dune.
"The change is happening so swiftly,"
Liatkin said, his voice tinged with awe.
"Surely, Shai Hulud is already here," Stilgar added.
Stuka echoed words that Garimi had said time and again.
"This world will be a new chapter house. The hardships will mean nothing to us."
With the detailed information in their archives, the people aboard the Ithaca had all the expertise they needed to establish a new place to live.
"Yes, a colony."
Teg rather liked the sound of the word because it represented the hope of a better future. Teg knew, however, that Duncan could never stop running unless he chose to face the enemy directly. The mysterious old man and woman were still after him with their sinister net, or after something on the no-ship, maybe the vessel itself. The lighter descended with a rough roar through the china-blue sky. In the middle of the abrupt desert band, dunes stretched as far as he could see. Sunlight reflected from the sands into bone-dry air, and thermal currents jostled the ship from side to side. Teg wrestled with the guidance systems. In the back, Stilgar chuckled.
"Just like riding a sandworm."
Cruising over the middle of the widening desert belt, Liatkynes pointed at a rusty red splash that marked an eruption from beneath the surface.
"Spice blow. No mistaking the color or pattern."
He gave a wry smile to his friend Stilgar.
"I died on one of those. Damn the Harkonnens for leaving me to die."
Mounds rippled and stirred the top layer of sand, but they did not emerge into open air.
"If those are worms, they are smaller than the ones in our hold," Stilgar said.
"But still impressive," Liat added.
"They have had less time to mature," Shiana pointed out.
"Mother Superior Odraid did not send volunteers on her scattering until after the desertification of Chapter House was well underway. And we do not know how long the Wandering Sisters took to get here." Below, obvious lines marked the rapid expansion of the sandy wasteland, like ripples on a pond. At the fringes were die-off perimeters, places where all vegetation had perished and the dirt had become blowing dust. The encroaching desert had created ghost forests and inundated villages. Flying low, searching with uneasy anticipation, Teg discovered half-buried rooftops, the pinnacles of once proud buildings drowned under the spreading desert. In one shocking glimpse, he saw a high dock and part of a capsized boat that sat atop a blistering dune.
"I look forward to seeing our Bene Gesserit sisters," Stuka sounded eager.
"Obviously, they succeeded here in their mission."
"I expect they will welcome us," Shiana admitted.
After seeing the city drowned in sand, Teg did not think the original inhabitants of this planet would have appreciated what the refugee sisters had done. As the lighter followed the northern edge of the desert, the scanners picked out small huts and tents erected just beyond the sand's reach. Teg wondered how often the nomadic villages were required to move. If the arid zone expanded as rapidly as it had on Chapter House, this world would be losing thousands of acres every day, and accelerating as sand trout continued to steal precious water.
"Set down at one of those settlements, Bashar," Shiana said to him. "Any of our lost sisters could be here on the edge of the dunes to monitor the progress."
"I long to feel real sand under my boots again," Stilgar muttered.
"It's all so fascinating," Liat said.
As Teg circled above one of the nomadic villages, people ran out and pointed up at them. Shiana and Stuka pressed excitedly against the plaza windows, searching for distinctive dark Bene Gesserit robes, but they saw none. A formation of rocks towered over the village, a bulwark offering shelter against blowing sand and dust. People, waving, stood atop the pinnacles, but Teg could not determine if the gestures were friendly or threatening.
"See, they cover their heads and faces with cloths and filters," Liet said. "The increased aridity forces them to adapt. In order to live here on the edge of the dry dunes, they are already learning to conserve bodily moisture."
"We could teach them how to make real stillsuits," Stilgar said with a smile.
"It has been a long time since I wore a decent one. I spent a dozen years aboard that ship, drowning my lungs with moisture. I can't wait to taste dry air again."
Teg found an open landing area and brought the lighter down. He felt unaccountably troubled as the natives scurried toward them. Those are obviously nomadic camps. Why wouldn't they move inland, to where the climate is more hospitable?
"People adapt," Shiana said.
"But why would they have to? Yes, the desert belt is growing, but there are still plenty of wide forests, even cities not far from here. Those people could outrun the spreading dunes for generations to come. Yet they stubbornly remain here."
Before the hatch opened to let in a breath of parched air, the nomads encircled the craft. Shiana and Stuka, both wearing traditional dark robes from Chapter House so that their refugee sisters would recognize them, boldly led the way. Teg followed with Stilgar and Liet.
"We are Bene Gesserit," Shiana called to the people in Universal Galak. "Are any of our sisters among you?"
Shielding her eyes against the brightness, she searched the few weathered female faces she saw, but got no response.
"Perhaps another village would be best," Teg suggested in a whisper. His tactical senses were alert.
"Not yet."
An elderly man drew closer, pushing a filter mask away from his face.
"You ask for Bene Gesserits? Here on Kelso?"
Though coarse, his accent was understandable. Despite his age, he appeared to be healthy and energetic. Taking the lead, Stuka stepped ahead of Shiana.
"The ones who wore black robes like ours, where are they?"
"All dead." The old man's eyes flashed.
Stuka's suspicion came too late. Moving like a striking snake, the man hurled a hidden knife from his sleeve with deadly accuracy. At an unseen signal, the rest of the throng rushed forward. Stuka plucked clumsily at the blade that protruded from her chest, but could not make her fingers work. Crumpling to her knees, she tumbled sideways off the lighter's ramp. Shiana was already moving, retreating. Teg shouted for Liet and Stilgar to get back inside the ship as he drew one of the stun weapons he had brought from the no-ship's armory. A large rock struck Stilgar in the head, and Liet helped his young friend, trying to drag him back into the lighter. Teg fired a swath of silvery energy, making part of the dusty mob collapse, but more knives and stones clattered at them. Frenzied people rushed the ramp from all sides, jumping at Teg. Many hands grabbed his wrist before he could fire again, and someone ripped the stunner out of his grip. More took hold of Liet by the shoulders, pulling him away. Shiana fought with a whirlwind of blows from her repertoire of Bene Gesserit fighting techniques. Soon, a crowd of fallen attackers lay around her. With a roar, Teg prepared to lurch into his hyper-accelerated metabolism, with which he could easily dodge blows and weapons. But a silvery beam from his own stunner gushed out like tinkling rain, dropping the Bashar, and then Shiana. In short order, the villagers bound the hands of their four prisoners with strong cords. Though badly beaten, Teg regained consciousness and saw that Liat and Stilgar were tied together. Stuka's body lay near the ramp while the attackers ransacked the lighter for equipment and hauled things off. A group of men lifted Stuka's body. The old man retrieved his knife, yanking it from the dead woman's chest and wiping it on her robe with an expression of revulsion. He glowered at the corpse and spat, then marched toward the prisoners. Looking at the three young men, he shook his head in disapproval. "I did not introduce myself. You may call me Var." Defiantly, Shiana glared up at him.
"Why have you done this to us? You said you knew of the Bene Gesserit order."
Var's face contorted, as if he had hoped to avoid speaking to her. He leaned close to Shiana.
"Yes, we know the Bene Gesserit. They came here years ago and delivered their demon creatures to our world. An experiment, they said."
"An experiment?
Look what they did to our beautiful land. It is becoming nothing more than useless sand."
He held his knife, considered Shiana for a long moment, then sheathed it. "When we finally realized what those women were doing, we killed them all. But too late. Our planet is dying now, and we will fight to protect what's left of it."
The first law of commercial viability is to recognize a need and meet it. When acceptable needs do not present themselves, a good businessman creates them in any way possible. Chome, Primary Commercial Directive. When yet another navigator died in his tank, few of the Spacing Guild's administrators mourned the loss. The giant Highliner was simply brought back to the Junction shipyards to be refit with one of the Ixian mathematical compilers. It was considered progress. After long years of practice, Crone easily concealed his pleasure at the sight. So far, every aspect of the wide-reaching plan had proceeded as expected, one domino falling after another. Posing in his familiar disguise as an Ixian inspection engineer, the leader of the Face Dancer Myriad waited on a high, copper-floored platform. He observed the clamorous shipyards while warm breezes and industrial fumes drifted around him. Nearby, the human administrator Rentel Goris was not quite as proficient at covering his satisfaction. He blinked his milky eyes and looked up toward the piloting bay of the ancient, decommissioned ship. "Ardra was one of the oldest remaining navigators in our commercial fleet. Even with his spice supplies drastically cut, he clung to life much longer than we expected." A plump Chome representative said, "Navigators, now that these drains on our resources are disappearing one by one, guild profits should increase significantly." Without prompting from his master, the Mentat assistant recited, "Knowing the lifetime of that navigator, and considering the quantities of melange required to institute his initial mutation and conversion, I have calculated the total amount of spice consumed during his service to the guild. With fluctuating prices based on the relative glut during the Tliloxu years and recent skyrocketing costs due to severe shortages, the guild could have bought 3 full-sized Highliners, complete with no field capabilities, for the same cost in spice." The Chome man muttered in disgust, while Crone remained silent. He found it most effective simply to listen and observe. Humans could be counted on to draw their own conclusions, often erroneous ones, so long as they were pointed in the proper direction.
Savoring his secrets, Crone thought of the numerous ambassadors the Guild had sent to the front, attempting to negotiate non-aggression treaties with the thinking machines, hoping to declare themselves neutral for the survival of the Guild. But many of those emissaries had been Crone's face dancer plants, who intentionally achieved no success. Others, the human ones, never returned from the encounters. With Richesi conveniently obliterated by rebel honored Matres, secretly guided by Crone's face dancers, humans had no choice but to turn to Ix and the Guild in order to obtain the technological items they required. The junction shipyards had always been immense complexes for constructing huge interstellar ships. Mirbella's defensive fleet was growing with remarkable speed, but Crone knew that even these efforts would not be very effective against the sheer size and scope of Omnius's military, which had been thousands of years in the making. The fabrication facilities of Ix, also controlled by face dancers, were still delaying the development and modification of the obliterator weapons upon which the Sisterhood's defense relied. And since every new guild ship was controlled by an Ixian mathematical compiler rather than a navigator, the Mother Commander and her allies would have many surprises in store. "We will build more ships to make up for the obsolescence of the navigators," Administrator Goris promised. "Our contract with the new Sisterhood seems infinite. We have never had so much business." "And yet interplanetary trade is down drastically." The Chome representative nodded to both Crone and Goris. "How is the Sisterhood to pay for these expensive ships and armaments?" "They have met their obligations with an increased flow of melange," Goris said. Crone finally nudged the conversation where he wished it to go. "Why not accept payment in horses or petroleum or some other outdated and useless substance? If your navigators are dying and your ships function perfectly well with Ixian mathematical compilers, the Guild no longer needs melange. What good is it to you?"
"Indeed, its value is greatly diminished. Over the past quarter century, following the destruction of Rakis, the Tliloxu worlds, and so much more, those who could afford spice recreationally have dwindled to a tiny number." The Chome representative glanced at his mentat, who nodded in agreement. "Chapter House might have a monopoly on melange, but by their very iron grip, by decreasing the amount of spice available for popular consumption, they have strangled their own market. Few people really need it anymore. Now that they have learned to live without spice, will they be so keen to reacquire their addictions?"
"Probably," Goris said. "You need only drop the price and we'd have a stampede of customers." "The witches still control Boozle," the Mentat pointed out. "They have other ways to pay." The Chome man disdainfully raised his eyebrows. He made very expressive noises without words. "Luxury items during war?
Not a good economic investment. Providing Sue Stones is no longer easy for them either," Goris pointed out,
"since sea monsters are destroying the shell beds and attacking their harvesters." Crone listened intently. His own spies had brought back disturbing but intriguing reports about strange happenings on Boozle and a possible secret navigator project centered there. He had demanded more information. Crone watched while jaw-like machinery on a large crane pried open the pilot's bay on the gigantic decommissioned Highliner.
Heavy suspensor lifters strained and groaned as they pulled out the navigator's thick-walled plas tank. During the slow, clumsy extraction, the tank caught on the edge of the hole in the highliner's structure. A hull plate broke off and spun downward, striking the side of the highliner and ricocheting with a shower of sparks, then tumbling until it finally slammed into the ground far below. Wisps of orange spice gas escaped from the navigator's chamber, stray exhaust vapors leaking into the atmosphere. Only a decade or so ago, such a quantity of wasted spice gas would have been enough to buy an imperial palace. Now the Chome representative and administrator Goris watched it dissipate without comment. Goris spoke into a tiny microphone at his collar.
"Deposit the tank in front of us. I wish to stare at it."
The crane raised the thick-walled chamber, swung it away from the hulk of the highliner, and brought it over to the observation platform. Suspensors lowered the container gently to the copper-floored deck, where it settled with a distressingly heavy thump. Spice gas continued to vent from the chink in the thick plas. The melange vapors smelled strangely flat and metallic, telling Crone that the navigator had inhaled and exhaled them until very little spice potency remained. At a curt direction from the milky-eyed administrator, silent guild workers unsealed a cap on the tank, causing the remainder of the spice to blast out in a death rattle. As the polluting gas drained, the murky clouds swirled and thinned, revealing a silhouetted form slumped inside. Crone had seen navigators before, of course, but this one was flaccid, gray-skinned, and very dead. The bulbous head and small eyes, webbed hands, soft amphibious-looking skin gave the thing the appearance of a large, misshapen fetus.
Ardra had died days earlier, starved for melange.
Though the guild now had plenty of spice in their stockpiles, Administrator Goris had cut off the navigator's supplies some time ago.
Behold, a dead navigator, a sight few will ever see again.
How many still survive among your guild ships? Crone asked. Goris seemed evasive.
Among the ships still in our inventory, only 13 navigators remain alive. We are on a death watch for them.
What do you mean, the ships still in your inventory? The Chome man asked.
Goris hesitated, then admitted, there were some still flown by navigators, vessels that we had not yet managed to equip with mathematical compilers. They have, how shall I say this? Over the past few months, they have disappeared.
Disappeared? How many highliners? Each ship is hugely expensive.
I do not have precise numbers. The Chome man had a hard voice.
Give us your best estimate.
500, perhaps 1,000.
1,000?
At his side, the Mentat held his silence, but he appeared as upset and startled as the Chome representative. Trying to demonstrate control over the situation, Goris said in an almost dismissive tone, "When starved for spice, the navigators grow desperate. It's not surprising that they take irrational action."
Crone himself was concerned, but he didn't show it. These disappearances sounded like a widespread conspiracy involving a navigator faction, something he had not expected.
"Do you have any idea where they might have gone?"
The guild administrator feigned nonchalance.
"It doesn't matter. They will run out of spice and die. Look at these shipyards and see how many vessels we are creating every day. Before long, we'll make up for the loss of those outdated ships and obsolete navigators.
Have no fear. After so many years of bondage to a single substance, the Guild is making a good business decision.
Thanks to your partners from Ix, Crone pointed out.
Yes,
thanks to Ix.
Following a lull, the noise of the shipyards became very loud. Welders went to work, and heavy machinery lifted curved components into place. A cargo hauler half a kilometer wide brought in two sets of Holtzman engines. The men continued to watch the magnificent activities for a long time in silence. None of them even looked again at the pathetic, dead navigator in his tank.
Humanity has many profound beliefs. Chief among them is the concept of home.
Bene Gesserit Archives, Analyses of Motivating Factors. The next time Edric's Highliner went to Boozle on a run, the vessel left the planet carrying something vastly more important than Sue Stones. Hidden on the sealed laboratory decks was a package of the uniquely powerful substance extracted from the slaughtered sea worm's strange, dense organ. With extravagant optimism, Woff had named it Ultra Spice. Tests proved that the potency went beyond that of any spice ever recorded. This remarkable substance would change everything for the Navigator faction. The Tleilaxu master also understood the importance of his achievement and meant to use it to his advantage. Without being summoned, he pushed past Guild security forces and made his way to the restricted levels reserved for the Navigator. Officiously ignoring all challenges, Woff opened thick doors until he stood before the plaz-walled tank that held Edric in his expensive bath of spice gas. Having succeeded in restoring at least one breed of worms, Woff was no longer a sycophant. He could make brash demands of his own. Woff's shortened Gola lifespan didn't give him much time to meet his critical goals, thus making him increasingly desperate. He was already well past his physical prime, and now his body was in a rapid plunge to degeneration and death. He probably had no more than a year or so left. Full of rigid defiance, Woff stood before Edric's tank and said, "Now that my altered sea worms are capable of creating spice in a form accessible by Guild navigators, I want you to take me to Rakkis." He no longer had anything to lose and everything to gamble. He crossed his thin arms over his chest in triumph. Swimming slowly, Edric drifted close to the plaz wall. The swirls of orange gas were hypnotic. "The new melange has not been proved in practice." "No matter. Its chemistry has been proved." Edric's voice grew louder through the speakers.
"I am troubled. In its original form, melange has complexities that cannot be revealed in any laboratory analysis."
"You worry unnecessarily," Woff said. "Seaworm spice is more potent than anything you have ever consumed. Try it yourself if you do not believe me."
"You are in no position to make demands."
"No one else could have accomplished what I did. Boozle will be your new source of melange. Sea worm hunters will harvest more ultra spice than you can possibly use, and navigators will no longer be dependent upon the Bene Gesserit witches or the black market. Even if the sisters decide to harvest the sea worms and try to create another monopoly, you can ignore them. By changing the worms instead of the planet, we can place them anywhere. I have given you the road to freedom."
Woff snorted, raised his voice.
"Now, I demand my payment."
"We kept you alive after the honored Matres were overthrown on Tleilax. Is that not sufficient compensation?
With a conciliatory sigh, the Tlilaxu Gola held his hands out.
What I ask will cost you little and gain you much honor. A blessing from God.
The navigator wore a look of displeasure on his distorted face.
What do you desire, little man?
I repeat, take me to Rakis.
Absurd. The world is dead.
Edric's words were flat.
Rakis is where my last body perished. So consider it a pilgrimage.
He continued in a rush, saying more than he had intended.
In my laboratory, I created more small worms from the remaining sand trout specimens. I have strengthened them, made them capable of surviving in the harshest environment. I can repopulate Rakis and bring back the prophet.
He abruptly fell silent. At the first rumors that the sea worms were thriving, Waff had turned his efforts to the last few sand trout in his original stock. Sculpting worm chromosomes for survival in a comfortable ocean environment had been a challenge. Much more difficult, though, was the task of toughening the monsters to survive out in the blasted wastelands of Rakis. But Waff did not turn his back on difficulty. All along, his goal had been to bring the sandworms back where they belonged. God's messenger must return to Dune. He studied Edric, who stroked with webbed hands as he considered the request.
Our oracle recently sent us a message calling upon navigators to leave the guild and join her in a great battle. That must be my priority now.
I implore you, take me to Rakis.
As if to remind Waff of his imminent mortality, a twinge of pain shot through his chest and down his spine. He needed all his effort not to show the anguish of dying, the misery of failure. He had so little time remaining.
Is that so much to ask?
Grant me this one favor at the end of my life.
That is all you wish to do. Die there.
I will spend my last energies on my sandworm specimens. Perhaps there is a way of reintroducing them to Rakis and regenerating the ecological systems. Think of it. If I succeed, you will have yet another source of melange.
You will not be pleased with what you find there. Even with moisture recycling, shelters, and equipment, survival on Rakis is more difficult than it has ever been. Your expectations are unrealistic. Nothing useful remains.
Waff tried unsuccessfully to keep desperation out of his voice.
Rakis is my home, my spiritual compass.
Edric thought it over, then said,
I can fold space to Rakis, but I cannot promise to return. The Oracle has called me.
I will remain there as long as necessary. God will provide for me.
Waff rushed back to his private research levels, intending to stay on the desert planet, undoubtedly for the rest of his life. He requisitioned all the supplies and equipment he might need for years, allowing him to be entirely self-sufficient on that bleak and lifeless world. After placing the order, he looked at his tanks where the new armored sandworms writhed, eager to be released.
Rakis. Dune was his destiny.
He felt in his heart that God had summoned him there, and if Waff perished on the planet, then so be it. He felt a warm, soothing wave of contentment. He understood his place in the universe. The blackened, faintly coppery ball appeared in the Highliner's private viewing plates. Waff had been so anxious gathering his things that he hadn't even felt the activation of the Holtzman engines, the folding of space. Edric surprised him by offering additional supplies and a small team of loyal guild assistants to help with the labor of setting up a camp and administering the experiments. Perhaps he wanted his own people on hand to see if the Tleilaxu man succeeded again with his worms. Waff didn't mind, so long as they stayed out of the way. Without introducing himself to the silent members of his new team, Waff directed the transfer of his armored sandworm specimens from the isolated lab. His self-erecting shelters and his equipment, everything they would need for survival on the charred world. One of the silent, smooth-faced guild assistants piloted the lighter. Before they reached the dead surface of Dune, the Highliner had already drifted out of orbit. Edric was anxious to be on his way to answer the Oracle's call, carrying its cargo of ultra spice and the tidings of new hope for all navigators. Waff, though, had eyes only for the blistered, lifeless landscape of the legendary world.
Bacteria are like tiny machines, notable for their effects on larger biological systems. In a similar way, humans behave as disease organisms among planetary systems and should be studied as such. Erasmus, Laboratory Notebooks. When the virulent plague reached Chapter House, the first cases appeared among the male workers. 7 men were struck down so swiftly that their dying expressions showed more surprise than pain. In the great hall where younger sisters dined, the disease also spread. The virus was so insidious that the most contagious period occurred a full day before any symptoms manifested. Thus, the epidemic had already sunk its claws into those most vulnerable before the new sisterhood even knew a threat existed. Hundreds perished within the first 3 days, more than 1,000 by the end of the week. After 10 days, the victims were beyond counting. Support staff, teachers, visitors, off-world merchants, cooks and kitchen help, even failed reverend mothers, all fell like stalks of wheat under the grim reaper's scythe. Mirbella called upon her senior advisors to develop an immediate plan, but from prior epidemics on other embattled planets, they knew that precautionary measures and quarantines would do no good. The conference room doors were securely locked because younger sisters and acolytes could not be allowed to know the strategies being discussed here. Survival of the sisterhood is our primary purpose, even as the rest of Chapter House dies around us. Mirbella felt sickened to think of all the unprepared acolytes, spice-harvesting teams in the Dune Belt, transport drivers, architects and construction workers, weather planners, greenhouse gardeners, cleaners, bankers, artists, archive workers, pilots, technicians, and medical assistants. All the underpinnings of Chapter House itself. Lyera attempted to sound objective, but her voice cracked. Reverend mothers have the precise cellular control needed to fight this disease on its own battleground. We can use our bodily defenses to drive away the plague. In other words, anyone who hasn't gone through the spice agony will die, Kyria said, like the honored Matres did. That was why we pursued you, Bene Gesserit, in the first place, to learn how to protect ourselves from the epidemic. Can we use the blood of Bene Gesserit survivors to create a vaccine? Mirbella asked. Lyera shook her head. Reverend mothers drive out disease organisms cell by cell. There are no antibodies we can share with others. It is not even as simple as that, Acadia rasped. A reverend mother can channel her inner biological defenses, only if she has the energy to do so,
and if she has the time and ability to concentrate on herself. But this plague forces us to turn our energies to tend the most unfortunate victims.
If you make that mistake, you'll die, just like our Shiana surrogate on Jibraith, Korea said with the undertone of a sneer in her voice. We reverend mothers will have to take care of ourselves and no one else. The others have no chance anyway. We need to accept that.
Mirbella already felt the beginnings of exhaustion, but her nervous anxiety made her pace the sealed council room. She had to think. What could be done against such a minute, lethal enemy? Only reverend mothers will survive. She spoke firmly to her advisors. Find every acolyte who is close to being ready for the agony. Do we have enough water of life?
For all of them? Cried Lyera.
For every single one. Any sister who has the slightest chance of survival. Give all of them the poison and hope they can convert it and survive the agony. Only then will they be able to fight off the plague.
Many will die in the attempt, warned Lyera.
Or all of them will die from the plague. Even if most of the candidates succumb to the agony, it's an improvement. She did not wince. Her own daughter Rinya had perished that way many years ago. Smiling slightly with her wrinkled lips, Acadia nodded.
A Bene Gesserit would rather die from the agony than from a sickness spread by our enemy. It is a gesture of defiance rather than surrender.
See that it is done.
In the death houses, she turned a deaf ear to the moans of the sick and dying. The chapter house doctors had drugs and potent analgesics, and the Bene Gesserit acolytes had been taught how to block off pain. Even so, the misery of the plague was enough to break the deepest conditioning. Mirbella hated to see the sisters unable to control their suffering. It shamed her, not for their weakness, but because she had been unable to prevent this from happening in the first place. She went to where lines of makeshift beds held young acolytes, most of them terrified, some of them determined. The room smelled of rancid cinnamon, harsh instead of pleasant. With her brow furrowed and eyes intent, the mother commander watched two stony-faced reverend mothers carry out a stretcher bearing the sheet-wrapped body of a young woman.
Another one failed the agony?
The reverend mothers nodded.
61 today.
They are dying as fast as from the plague.
And how many successes?
43.
43 that will live to fight the enemy.
Like a mother hen, Mirbella walked up and down the line of beds, observing the plague-stricken sisters, some sleeping quietly with new bodily awareness, others writhing in deep comas from which it was uncertain they would ever find their way back. At the end of the row, a teenage girl lay with frightened eyes. She propped herself up in bed on trembling arms. She met Mirbella's gaze, and even in her extreme sickness, the girl's eyes glimmered.
Mother Commander,
she said hoarsely. Mirbella moved closer to the young one.
What is your name?
Baileth.
Are you waiting to undergo the agony?
I'm waiting to die, Mother Commander. I was brought here to take the water of life. But before it could be administered, the symptoms of the disease manifested themselves. I'll be dead before the end of the day.
She sounded very brave.
So they will not give you the water of life, then? You won't even attempt the agony?
Baileth lowered her chin.
They say I will not survive it.
And you believe them? Aren't you strong enough to try?
I am strong enough to try, Mother Commander.
Then I'd rather you died trying instead of giving up.
As she looked down at Baileth, she was poignantly reminded of Rinya.
eager and confident, so like Duncan.
But her daughter hadn't been ready after all, and she had died on the table.
I should have delayed her. Because of my need to prove myself, I pushed Rinya. I should have waited.
And Mirbella's youngest daughter, Jian, what had happened to her? The mother commander had kept herself apart from the young woman's day-to-day activities, letting the sisterhood raise her. But in this time of crisis, she decided to ask someone, Laera, perhaps, to track her down. Right now, Baeleth seemed to show hope, looking with fervid eyes toward the mother commander. Mirbella ordered the Sook doctors to attend to her immediately.
Time is shorter for this one than for the others.
From the doctors' skeptical expressions, Mirbella could see they considered this a waste of the valuable water of life, but she stood firm. Baeleth accepted the viscid draft, took a last look at her mother commander, and gulped the toxic substance. She lay back, closed her eyes, and began her fight. It did not last long. Baeleth died in a valiant attempt, but Mirbella could feel no guilt about it. The sisterhood must never stop fighting.
The melange was rare and precious. Rarer still was the water of life. By the fourth day of Mirbella's desperate plan, it became apparent that Chapter House's supplies would not be sufficient. Sister after sister consumed the poison, and many perished while struggling to convert the deadly toxin in their cells, trying to change their bodies. The Mother Commander tasked her advisors to study the exact amount of poison necessary to trigger the agony. Some Reverend Mothers suggested diluting the substance, but if they didn't give enough to be fatal, and thus effective, the entire experiment would fail. Dozens more sisters died. More than 60% of those who took the poison. Kyria offered a hard but coldly logical solution. Assess each candidate, and dole out the water of life only to those most likely to succeed. We can't gamble foolishly. Each dose we give to a woman who fails is wasted. We must discriminate.
Mirbella disagreed. None of them has a chance unless they undergo the agony. The whole point of this operation is to give it to everyone, and the most fit will survive. The women stood amidst the bedlam of the dormitory rooms in the sick houses that had been converted from any building large enough to accommodate beds. Four lifeless bodies were carried past them by exhausted-looking Reverend Mothers. They had run out of sheets, so the corpses were uncovered, their faces twisted in a display of the incalculable pain they had suffered. Ignoring the dead, Mirbella knelt beside the bed of one young woman who survived. She had to look at the casualty total from a different perspective. If they were all destined to die, it was a fruitless exercise to count those who perished. In that light, the only relevant number was the tally of those who did recover. The victories. If we don't have enough water of life, use other poisons.
Mirbella got wearily to her feet, ignoring the smells, the sounds. The Bene Gesserit may have determined that the water of life is most effective at forcing the agony, but long ago the sisters used other deadly chemicals. Anything that would push the body into an absolute crisis. She perused the young students, these girls who had hoped one day to grow up to become Reverend Mothers. Now each of them had one chance and one chance only. Poison them one way or another. Poison them all. If they survive, they belong here.
A courier ran up to her, one of the younger sisters who had recently survived the transformation.
Mother Commander, you are needed immediately in archives.
Mirbella turned. Has Acadia found something?
No, Mother Commander. You have to see for yourself.
the younger woman swallowed.
And hurry.
The ancient woman did not have the strength to leave her office. Acadia sat surrounded by wire spool readers and stacks of data-dense crystal sheets. She sprawled back in her large chair, breathing heavily, barely able to move. The old woman's rheumy eyes flickered open.
So, you've come. In time.
Mirbella looked at the archivist, appalled. Acadia, too, had the plague.
But you are a reverend mother. You can fight this.
I am old and tired. I used the last of my stamina to compile our records and projections, to map out the spread of this disease. Maybe we can prevent it on other worlds.
Doubtful. The enemy distributes the virus wherever they consider it strategic.
Already she had made up her mind to have several other reverend mothers share with Acadia. Her extensive memories and knowledge must not be lost. Acadia struggled to sit up in the chair.
Mother Commander, don't be so focused on the epidemic that you fail to see its consequences.
She began coughing. Blotches had appeared all over her skin, the advanced stages of the disease.
This plague is a mere foray, a test attack. On many planets it is sufficient, but the enemy must know the Sisterhood well enough by now to be sure we can fight this, at least to a point. After they soften us up, they'll attack by other means.
Mirbella felt cold inside.
If thinking machines destroy the new Sisterhood, then the remaining fragments of humanity will have no chance of resisting them. We are the most important hurdle Omnius has to overcome.
So you finally understand the implications.
The old woman grasped the Mother Commander's hand to make sure she understood.
This planet has always been hidden. But now the thinking machines must know the location of Chapter House. I would wager that their space fleet is already on its way.
One man's dream is another's nightmare. A saying of Old Catane. After dragging Stuka's body away, the nomads separated Shiana and Teg from Stilgar and Liet Kynes. Apparently, they saw the two boys, 12 and 13, as no threat, not knowing that both were deadly Fremen fighters whose clear memories held many raids against the Harkonnens. Teg recognized the strategy.
The old leader wants to interrogate our young ones first.
Var and his hard-bitten comrades would assume the youths would be easily intimidated, not capable of resisting difficult questioning. Teg and Shiana were taken to a holding tent made of a tough, weather-worn polymer. The structure was an odd mixture of primitive design and sophisticated technology, made for serviceability and ease of transport. The guard closed the flap but remained outside. The windowless tent was just an empty enclosure, devoid of blankets, cushions, or tools of any kind. Teg paced in a small circle, then sat beside her on the packed dirt. Digging with his fingers, he quickly found a couple of sharp pebbles. With Mentat clarity, he assessed their options.
"When we do not return or report in," he said in a low voice, "we can expect Duncan to send another party down. He will be prepared. It sounds trite, but rescue will come."
He knew that these nomads would crumble easily against a direct military assault.
"Duncan is wise, and I trained him well. He will know what to do."
Shiana stared at the door as if in meditative trance.
"Duncan has lived hundreds of lives and remembers them all, Miles.
I doubt you taught him anything new.
Teg gripped one of the pebbles, and it seemed to aid his concentration. Even in an empty tent, he saw 1,000 possible avenues of escape. He and Shiana could easily break out, kill the guard, and fight their way back to the lighter. Teg might not even need to take advantage of his accelerated speed.
These people are no match for me or for you, but I will not leave Stilgar and Liat behind.
Ah, the loyal Bashar.
I wouldn't leave you either. However, I fear that these people have disabled our ship, which would certainly tangle our escape plans. I heard them ransacking it.
Shiana continued to stare at the shadowy wall of the tent.
Miles, I'm not so concerned about the possibility of escape as I am curious to learn why they kept us alive. Especially me, if what they said about the Sisterhood is true. They have good reason to hate me.
Teg tried to imagine the incredible exodus and reorganization of populations on this planet. Within years, all the inhabitants of the towns and cities would have seen the sands strangling their croplands, killing their orchards, creeping closer and closer to the city boundaries. They would have pulled away from the desert zone like people fleeing a slowly advancing fire.
Vars nomads, though.
Were they scavengers and misfits? Outcasts from the larger population centers? Why insist on staying at the threshold of the advancing desert, where they would have to uproot their settlement and retreat constantly? To what purpose?
These were technologically capable people, and Kelso clearly must have been settled long ago during the scattering.
They had their own ground cars and low-altitude flyers, fast ships to take them back and forth across the dunes. If they weren't outright exiles, perhaps Var's people replenished their supplies in the distant northern cities.
Teg and Shiana hardly spoke for hours as they listened to the muffled sounds outside, the dry wind pushing and tugging at the tent, the scritch of blowing sand. Everything seemed to be comprised of movement outside. The people sent out parties, marched back and forth, set machinery to work. As Teg listened to the noises, he catalogued them in his mind, building a picture of the operations.
He heard a pounding drill that bored a well shaft, followed by a pump dispensing water into small cisterns. Each time, after only a brief gush of liquid, the flow dwindled to less than a trickle and stopped. He knew that such problems, caused by sand trout, had been the bane of drilling operations on Arrakis.
Water existed in deep enough strata, but it was blocked off by the voracious little makers. Like platelets at the site of a wound, sand trout would swiftly seal off the leak. As he listened to the resigned complaints of these people, Teg realized that they were familiar with the routine. When night fell, a dusty young man entered the tent through the flap held open by the guard. He delivered a small meal of hard bread and dried fruit, as well as gamey-tasting white meat. The two captives also received carefully measured rations of water. Shiana looked at her sealed cup.
They are learning the fundamentals of extreme conservation. They begin to understand what their world will become. Obviously despising her Bene Gesserit robes, the young man glared at her and departed without a word. Throughout the dark night, Teg remained awake, listening, trying to plan. The lack of activity was maddening, but he advised patience rather than rash action. They had heard nothing from Liat or Stilgar, and he feared the two young men might already be dead, like Stuka. Had they been killed during interrogation? Shiana sat beside him in a heightened state of alertness. Her eyes were bright even in the tent shadows. As far as Teg could tell, the guard outside never stepped away from his position, never even moved.
The people continued to send out parties and skimmer ships throughout the night, as if the camp were the staging area for a war effort. At dawn, old Var came up to the tent, spoke briskly with the guard, and pulled the flap aside. Shiana rose to a half-crouch, ready to spring. Teg tensed, also prepared for a fight. The nomad leader glared at Shiana.
You and your witches are not forgiven for what you have done to Kelso. You never will be. But Liet Kynes and Stilgar have convinced us to keep you alive, at least as long as we can learn from you. The weathered leader brought the pair out into the bright sunlight. The wind flung stinging sand into their eyes. All around the settlement, trees had already died. The blowing dunes had encroached another few feet past the prominent rock outcroppings during the night. Each breath was crackling dry, even in the relative coolness of the morning.
You put the other Bene Gesserits to death, Shiana said,
and killed our companion Stuka.
Am I next?
No, because I said I would keep you alive.
The weathered man led them through the settlement. Workers were already disassembling large warehouse tents to move them farther from the edge of the sand. A heavy ground car rumbled by, full of crates. A bloated flyer circled and landed near the smooth sand. Some kind of tanker? Var led them to a large central building made from sectional metal walls and a conical roof. Inside, a long table was cluttered with charts. Reports were fastened to the walls, and one entire wall displayed a polymer paper map, a high-resolution topographic projection of the entire continent. Mark after mark showed the steady growth of the desert belt. Men sat around the table sharing reports and raising their voices in a tumult of conversation. Stilgar and Liet Kynes, both dressed in dusty ship suits, waved a greeting at the other two prisoners. The young men seemed pleased and relaxed. As he scanned the setup, it was obvious to Teg that Stilgar and Liet had spent the whole previous day in the command tent. The old leader positioned himself between them, leaving Teg and Shiana to stand. Var pounded on the table, interrupting the cacophony. Everyone stopped talking, impatiently it seemed, and stared at him.
We have listened to our new friends describe what our world is sure to become. We've all heard legends of long-lost Dune, where water is more precious than blood.
His face had a pinched look.
If we fail and the worms take over, our planet will become valuable only by the standards of outsiders.
One of the men snarled at Shiana,
"Damn Bene Gesserits!"
The others glared at her as well, and she met their disapproval squarely, without comment.
Liet and Stilgar seemed to be in their element. Teg recalled the Bene Gesserit discussions over the original Gola project, how the long-forgotten abilities of those historical personages might become relevant again. Here was a perfect example. This duo of prominent survivors from the old days of Arrakis certainly knew how to deal with the crisis these people now faced. The grizzled leader raised his hands, and his voice sounded as dry as the air.
After the death of the tyrant long ago, my people fled into the scattering. When they reached Kelso, they thought they had found Eden. It was a paradise for 1,500 years afterward.
The men glowered at Shiana. Var explained how the refugees had established a thriving society, built cities, planted crops, mined for metals and minerals. They had no wish to overextend themselves or go searching for other lost brothers who had escaped during the famine times.
Then a few decades ago, everything changed. Visitors came. Bene Gesserits. At first, we welcomed them, glad to have news from the outside.
We offered them a new home. They became our guests. But the ingrates raped our entire planet, and now it is dying.
Another man clenched his hands into fists as he picked up the story. The sand trout multiplied out of control. Huge forests and vast plains died within years. Only a few years. Great fires started in the wastelands, and weather patterns changed, turning much of our world into a dust bowl.
Teg spoke up, using his command voice. If Liat and Stilgar told you about our no-ship and its mission, then you know we don't carry sand trout, and we have no intention of harming your world. We stopped here only to replenish vital supplies.
In fact, we fled the heart of the Bene Gesserit Order because we disagreed with the policies and leadership, Shiana added.
You have 7 large sandworms in your hold, Var accused.
Yes, and we will not release them here.
Liat Kynes spoke quietly, as if lecturing children.
As we already told you, once it has begun, the desertification process is a chain reaction. The sand trout have no natural enemies, and their insisting of water is so swift that nothing can adapt quickly enough to fight against them.
Nevertheless, we will fight, Var said. You see how simply we live in this camp. We have given up everything to stay here.
But why? Shiana asked. Even as the desert spreads, you have many years to prepare.
Prepare? Do you mean surrender? You may call it a hopeless fight, but it is still a fight. If we cannot stop the desert, we will at least slow it. We'll battle the worms and the sands. The men at the table muttered. No matter what you say, we will try to hinder the desert's progress in every way. We kill sand trout. We hunt the new worms. Var stood up, and the others followed suit. We are commandos, sworn to slow the death of our world.
The desert still calls me. It sings in my blood like a love song.
Liat Kynes, Planetology, New Treatises.
Early the next morning, Var led his group of dusty, determined fighters to a landing zone of fire-baked pavement.
Today, my new friends, we'll show you how to kill a worm. Maybe 2.
Shai-Ulud, Stilgar said with great uneasiness. Fremen used to worship the great worms.
Fremen depended upon the worms and the spice, Liat replied quietly.
These people do not.
With each demon we eliminate, we give our planet a little more time to survive.
Var stared out into the desert as if his hatred could drive back the sands.
Stilgar followed the man's gaze across the deeply shadowed dunes, trying to imagine the landscape in front of him as lush and green. The sun was just rising over an escarpment, glinting off the silvery hull of an old low-altitude flyer parked on an area of pounded gravel and flash-fused cement. Var's people did not bother with permanent landing strips or spaceport zones, which would only be swallowed up by the spreading dunes. Despite the protests of the 2 young men, Shiana and Teg were forced to remain behind in the camp as hostages, watched suspiciously. Liat and Stilgar had been accepted on the hunt because of their invaluable knowledge of the desert. Today, they would demonstrate their skills. Var's commandos clambered into the heavily used craft. It had obviously weathered countless storms, rough flights, and incomplete maintenance. Its hull was scuffed and scraped. The interior smelled of oil and sweat, and the seats were stone-hard, with only bars or straps for the passengers to hold on to.
Stilgar felt comfortable enough among the 20 weathered, grim men. To his trained eye, the commandos had a look of edgy anticipation, but they were too soft in the flesh for the adaptations they would soon face. With the rapid climate shift, even living in their nomadic camps at the fringe of the sand, these people remained unaware of the desert's true